Chapter 7. Roberto. 21 hours later, I was in the thick of it. A roly-poly Portuguese colonel, Santos Castro, sat before me in the bare servants' quarters of an abandoned house in Ambriz, and told me he was surrounded by ambitious fools. His face was shadowed by the light of a candle, whose flame danced in the ocean breeze. His muted, conspiratorial voice was difficult to hear above the crashing surf. "They all want Angola," he said, "but I have the key. Without me, they have nothing." Castro was one of the people I had come to see, but it hadn't been easy to reach him. It had, in fact, been a long and wearing day. To begin with, McCalla had arrived late for our departure, and the FNLA truck that was to take us to the airport never showed up. We had to ride in a CIA carryall with U.S. Embassy plates, and that upset the guards at the military gate of Najili Airport. Eventually, bribes and phone calls got us in, and two of Mobutu's mercenary pilots, a Dane and a Belgian, flew us to Carmona in a 30-year-old DC-4. As we flew, I leaned over their shoulders in the cockpit, watching the forest below and listening to their grumbling about their Zairean employers. They are monkeys, I tell you, monkeys. Footnote. This term, macaque in French, was commonly used by the whites in colonial Africa. Since independence, it is taboo. Had McCalla, sitting behind me in the plane, heard and reported the two pilots, they might have been expelled from Zaire. End footnote. The pilots had not been paid for 5 months, and they were about to quit. We had been given a hasty tour of Carmona, the capital of the northern province of Angola, by three young FNLA politicians who coldly refused to answer questions and soon dropped us back at the airport, thirsty and unfed. I wondered if we were putting our best foot forward. St. Martin had insisted that I play a journalist cover role, at least until Roberto joined us the next day. Carmona, on the other hand, only merited a hasty tour. It was a ghost town, its shops and houses locked and chained shut, waiting as a prize for the winners of the Angolan Civil War. At the airport, Carmona's last 100 Portuguese awaited evacuation to Luanda. Their faces showed the despair of all refugees, whether the Belgians I had seen fleeing the Congo in 1960, or more recently, the frantic mobs leaving Vietnam. Eventually, a small plane ferried us to Ambriz, a smaller abandoned town on the coast. Our arrival at the tiny dirt airstrip was something of a diplomatic failure. The FNLA command had not been told we were coming, and was skeptical of my journalistic credentials. Perhaps the 15 boxes of radio equipment threw them off, or my camera may have threatened them. An African commander in new utilities, with a web belt, a new Browning 9mm pistol, and canvas ammunition pouches, drove up in a jeep and marched directly to me. He was flanked by two Portuguese commandos, whose machine guns were held level, the big muzzles pointing at my empty stomach. The black spoke to me harshly in Portuguese. "I beg your pardon," I said in English. "You are under arrest," one of the Portuguese said. "Give him your camera." "I beg your pardon," I repeated. "This is a war zone. We do not allow photographs. We do not allow reporters. You are under arrest. You will give him your camera and come with us." So much for the reporter story. Those were real guns pointed at my gut, loaded and cocked, and the faces behind them weren't smiling. I drew myself up. "I am not a reporter. I am not a tourist, and I am not a missionary, either. I am a colonel in the American service, and a personal representative of Dr. Kissinger. President Roberto invited me to come to Ambriz, and to take any pictures necessary for my mission. He will be here tomorrow to show me your camps and your forces." The black commander did not understand English. He reached impatiently for my camera. Obviously, a nonverbal gesture was required of me to establish authority. "This camera has no importance," I said. Swinging the $300 Pentax by its strap, I hurled it 30 feet into some trash. That seemed to impress them. At least I hoped it had. I wanted nothing more to do with low-level political hacks. I wanted my identity, my status, and my mission understood. I wanted to see the military installations, meet the commanders, talk operations, and have the prime players seek me out. And now, unless I had miscalculated, they would. I was not eager to get back into that plane, with nowhere to go but MPLA-held Luanda. Following a few moments of silence, there was a murmur of discussion as someone translated my remarks. Then the sound of machine guns being dropped in the back of the jeep. One of the African soldiers retrieved my camera. Wiping it off with his shirt, he draped it around my neck. They guided me to the jeep, mumbling apologies, and we drove into town. My communicators followed in a Volkswagen bus with the gear. I sat stiffly in the co-pilot's seat of the jeep, not speaking. I was still very thirsty. The airstrip was directly on the edge of town. Our jeep took us around a small traffic circle and six blocks down the principal street to a nondescript house near the end. I had already seen from the plane window that two blocks away, on my left, was the Atlantic Ocean. Two blocks on my right were bluffs which dropped off into the broad marsh. In front were rocky cliffs descending to a small river which opened to the sea. It was a lovely promontory for a sleepy tropical town, but a potential trap for an army central command post. Moments later, I had settled into a cane chair on the veranda of a small colonial house to the indescribable pleasure of the first beer. The communicators in their 15 boxes had disappeared into the communications center down the street. Portuguese commandos in camouflage uniforms came and went through the house. Two Africans, who seemed important, disappeared inside. At the end of a long hall, three drab Portuguese women were preparing food. This was the new central command post, to which the FNLA had fled 3 weeks before, when the MPLA pushed them out of Luanda. 70 miles north of the capital, it was safe from raids and surprise attack, but still close enough to support a counteroffensive. Though not really a port, Ambriz provided a haven for small boats, which could carry messages and even raid down the coast. One of the Portuguese commandos joined me, a Captain Bento, as he introduced himself. He was forming a commando unit with white officers and black troops. According to him, the Africans were too stupid to lead anything, although they could be shaped into fair soldiers. All this was said in a loud voice, without concern that African commanders were listening nearby. When Bento went back inside the command post, as if on cue, another white appeared, one who had been among the machine gun wielders at the airport. Introducing himself as Falstaff, he too seemed eager to talk. 10 days later, back at headquarters, I would trace Falstaff in the CIA computer and learn that he was a Brazilian journalist who had been on the CIA payroll years before. He had not lost the habit of reporting. Captain Bento was, according to Falstaff, a famous anti-guerrilla fighter from Mozambique, but I should beware of him, for he and a Colonel Santos Castro were rivals in the FNLA command. Each would attempt to draw me into his web. According to Falstaff, 40 Portuguese army veterans had cast their lot with the FNLA. In reality, they were Angolans, white Angolans, who had never lived in Portugal. In any case, they were not mercenaries. They received no money from the FNLA, but rather were fighting for their homes and their businesses, for the only life they knew. This was a familiar refrain for colonials who had fallen on hard times. Bento was an exception, a seasoned fighter who had followed the crest of conflict from Mozambique to Angola to indulge his passion, anti-Marxist wars. "Why was I treated so harshly at the airport?" I asked. Falstaff explained. These white soldiers had families still under MPLA control in Luanda. All were using aliases and taking precautions to keep their association with the FNLA secret. They did not want to be photographed by an unknown journalist. As we sat down to a skimpy meal of dried salt fish cooked in palm oil, with a healthy sprinkling of ground red peppers and some boiled potatoes, I was introduced with little formality to Colonel Castro, Bento's rival, and to an African, Hendrik Vial Neto, who I recognized as I.A. Castle IV, the FNLA politician who had been Minister of Interior in the transitional government in Luanda. Bento and Falstaff sat at the far end of the table with others who were not introduced to me. Holden Roberto had not arrived. We ate in virtual silence. Either they were cooling it until Roberto showed up and confirmed my story, or there was too much rivalry and mistrust among these FNLA leaders. When I tried to converse, Colonel Castro gave me a, "Sorry, I no speak English." Neto looked at me blankly and mumbled brusque answers to my questions. Bento gave me one hard look and concentrated on his food. Only Falstaff, perhaps eager to get back on the payroll, responded, smiling and nodding. It didn't catch on. Silence reigned. Of these men, Castro was the most consequential, and I looked him over as we ate. He was small and bald, but somehow managed to look urbane, even in a sports shirt in this rustic middle-class colonial dining room. After the meal, he called forth enough English to bemoan his inability to offer me a good whiskey, then disappeared into the night. Returning to the veranda alone, I settled into a chair, discouraging the communicators from joining me. I wanted no inhibition on my freedom to mix with Africans and Portuguese. The lights went out abruptly, and silence engulfed the sleepy tropical town as a big diesel somewhere in the background stopped its muffled roar. Neto brought me a candle and some matches. Diesel fuel had to be conserved, he apologized. He would not join me. I left the candle unlit and relaxed into my chair, knowing from experience that everyone would bed down early. Nothing so curtails a community's social life as darkness. Rubber-soled boots scraped quietly on the dirt walk. I became aware of a man's shadowy form mounting the steps of the veranda. He paused a moment, then moved toward me. My muscles began to tighten. It was pitch black on the veranda, and I was in the darkest corner near some climbing honeysuckle. How did he know where I was sitting? Had he been watching me from across the street before the lights went out? I waited silently while he approached, unable to suppress the melodramatic thought that I was in the middle of a bloody civil war. Did the FNLA command include infiltrators, who would be only too happy to embarrass Roberto by having Dr. Kissinger's representative turn up missing or dead? My visitor stopped 2 feet away and reached towards me, both hands close together. As I drew back, my muscles quivering with adrenaline, a dim flashlight snapped on in one hand, its light directed at a bit of paper in the other, which he pushed down into my lap, where they couldn't be seen from inside the house. On the paper was scrawled in pencil, "Please come and see me. This man will show you the way. Castro." The light clicked off and the man receded. I rose, picking up my travel bag, and followed him out the gate, thinking that in the spook business, one takes a lot on faith. He led me silently 2 blocks toward the circle, 1 block toward the sea, and down an alley into what appeared to be servants' quarters behind a small house. Seated at a small wooden table was Colonel Castro, his round face and gray hair caught in a candle's flickering light. He motioned to a second chair. My guide disappeared as quietly as he had come. "Good evening," he said. "Thank you for coming to see me. It is important that you and I talk seriously, here. Those others," he waved his hand, throwing a broad shadow against the wall, "they are idiots. They want Angola, but they don't know how to get Angola. I know how. I have the key. I am sorry I cannot offer you a drink. We have nothing here." I thrust a hand deep into my bag and pulled out a flask of scotch that I carried for such occasions. Castro smiled as I set it on the table. "Your Dr. Kissinger provides well." I produced 2 small tumblers and poured. Santos Castro was a third-generation white Angolan whose grandfather had established himself in northern Angola before the turn of the century, when there were only 10,000 whites in the entire country. Educated in Luanda and in Lisbon, he had done 20 years in the Portuguese colonial army, rising to the rank of colonel. For years, he had been governor of the northern Uiga province, among those responsible for the Portuguese army's harsh reprisals against the FNLA guerrillas. As times had changed, so had Castro's loyalties. Now he worked for his lifetime enemy, Holden Roberto, as chief of staff in the FNLA army. Castro's key to Angola turned out to be a little shop-worn. 600 Portuguese army veterans, he claimed, were poised in South Africa, awaiting his call. All were white Angolans, experienced in dealing with black guerrillas. They lacked only plane tickets and the means to fight. With them, Castro would have no trouble retaking Luanda for Roberto or for Dr. Kissinger. It was a typical white colonial solution to a black African problem. Give me a company of commandos, and I'll straighten this place out in 2 weeks flat. I suppressed an urge to argue with him. He was, after all, the best source of information I had found. Instead, I asked him about Luanda and other Portuguese still on the scene who might influence the course of the war. Castro wanted what all such adventurers want, money. In this case, money to field his 600 men, even though they were not mercenaries, he proclaimed earnestly. Nevertheless, they had families to support. How much? He was grandly vague, perhaps 1,000 each. 600,000 would get them started, plus some airplanes and arms. Oh yes, there was another requirement, an exclusive agreement which would eliminate rival Portuguese adventurers such as Bento. Roberto could be the figurehead, although we should deal with Castro on substantive matters. When I was confident I knew everything he was going to tell me that night, I rose to leave. We worked out future communications. He gave me addresses where he could be contacted in South Africa and Madrid, as well as Ambrise. In turn, I passed him a discreet identification phrase, which would get a message to me through the Kinshasa embassy telephone. Gesturing for him to keep the scotch, I stepped outside. The other effect of having no electricity is that everyone is up at dawn. I joined them and spent the morning walking about, seeking answers to the obvious questions. We knew almost nothing about the war front in northern Angola. How big was Ambrise? Small. 1,000 whites and 10,000 Africans before it became a ghost town. How important? Vital. It was the FNLA's forward command post and airstrip. Our tons of arms would come in here. How many FNLA troops? In Ambrise, I counted 25 soldiers, plus a few dozen uniformed hangers-on. Roberto had claimed 1,500. Equipment? There were more rifles and mortars than soldiers. Our shipments were arriving. Foreign advisors? 20 Portuguese and 2 Brazilians. Chinese advisors? I couldn't find a trace of anything Oriental. The Chinese weren't crossing the border into Angola. Leaders and fighting capability? I withheld judgment. I would have to get closer to the fighting front to answer all my questions. On the cliffs near the river's mouth, I stood for several minutes looking at the surf. Huge waves were cresting far out to sea, rolling majestically in to break and surge up the beach. This was world-class surf, but Ambrise was a long way from being known as a surfing resort. The waters of the Atlantic are dark and ominous off the West African coast, and have bred fear in African and European minds for centuries, sparking tales of sea monsters and mysterious currents. No one was completely immune to that superstition, myself included. Early 1961, as reconnaissance officer on a Navy cruise, which President Kennedy called Solent Amity, I had run covert hydrographic surveys of beach gradients and sand composition up and down the western coast of Africa, in Monrovia, Lome, Conakry, Pointe Noire, and Bathurst. My men and I would take a Peter boat and fake a beer party while we dived and took soundings. Footnote: a Peter boat is an ancient Navy landing craft. End footnote. None of us, though highly trained reconnaissance Marines, had much stomach for the murky depths 100 yards from the beach. By habit, I noted the Ambrise beach gradient. It was steep, the sand coarse and bottomless. It would handle amphibious landing craft badly. Downtown Ambrise, like Carmona, was deserted and buttoned up. There were only a few African men in civilian clothes wandering about aimlessly. After a breakfast of fruit, cheese, and rather good coffee, I examined the FNLA Communications Center. My communicators were well established. their radios set up and in good contact with Kinshasa via the relay station in Monrovia. There was no message from headquarters, and I sent a simple, "All's well." Given more time, I might have tried to understand why radio waves would reach 1,500 kilometers to Monrovia, but not 500 direct to Kinshasa. I walked back across town to a broad field overlooking the ocean and watched Captain Bento hold muster on his commandos. There were 7 whites and 15 blacks. Later, they formed into a large squad and practiced very basic infantry maneuvers, attacking an imaginary enemy position near the beach. At least the blacks did, running a few yards and diving into prone positions at the roared commands of one of the Portuguese. The whites stood near the trucks and watched. From previous experience, I felt I could project the effectiveness and shortcomings of the African soldiers, but I wondered about the Portuguese. Were they fit? For commandos, they were doing a lot of slouching around. And what was their military experience? Years of chasing poorly armed FNLA guerrillas through the bush wouldn't prepare them for conventional warfare, or give them the skills to handle heavy mortars, artillery, rockets, and armored vehicles. Doubtless they would learn fast and make good soldiers, if we had a year to get them ready. We had only weeks if we were going to halt the MPLA before the November independence date. A lone Panhard armored car, slightly larger than a Jeep, roared up and stopped, locking its wheels and sliding comically in a swirl of dust. A young white jumped out and stood by the building, posing. I decided that we had better not count too heavily on the Portuguese commandos saving northern Angola for us. Roberto drove in from the airstrip and shook my hand distractedly. He had on slacks, a light jacket, and a beige golf cap. I barely had time to get a glass of water before he ushered me into one of the new Volkswagen minibuses, and we drove away. With us were 3 whites, a tall, broad Portuguese named Xavier, a heavyset man dressed in a uniform complete with major's insignia, parachute wings, and a red beret, and Falstaff. Falstaff later told me that Xavier had been the chief of the Portuguese intelligence service in Luanda during the years of struggle against the black nationals. Now, like Colonel Castro, he was lending his ability and knowledge of the MPLA to the FNLA cause. According to Falstaff, the one in utilities was a Brazilian army major. Apparently, there is an observer. And what were Falstaff and a Brazilian major doing in Ambriz? Falstaff ducked this question, changing the subject. But the answer was obvious. Brazil was not uninterested in the Angolan outcome. There was a delay of 30 minutes at the motor pool, where Roberto inspected vehicles, counted spare parts, measured gasoline, and harassed all present, white and black alike. He did more talking than listening, and often interrupted people, leaving them frustrated. Then we were rolling down the asphalt road through the Angolan bush. I stood with my head and shoulders through the sunroof of the minibus to photograph the terrain through which we were passing. It was open, dry, and reasonably even. 60% was covered with meter-high grass over low rolling ridges and slopes, with scatterings of thorn, fig, and wild olive and cedar trees, which clustered into small forests. Occasional paunchy sentinel baobab trees made the terrain unforgettably African. Coastal woody savanna, I believed it would be called, ideal for the movements of a battalion reinforced with light armor, permitting high mobility as well as good cover. Of course, this type of war would be fought mostly up and down the roads. We were on a reasonably good, narrow asphalt road, designed to carry the 5-ton Mercedes and Berlier trucks which had kept the Angolan coffee business and provincial economy rolling. We crossed 2 small bridges over dry swales, which would be easy to detour around, except perhaps during a heavy rain. Another bridge spanned a deep creek bed with steep, rough sides. An abutment had been partially blown by an MPLA mine, but was still solid enough for single-axle trucks and even armored vehicles no larger than the small Panhards. Such streams could pose serious problems if a span were completely blown. True, a U.S. Army engineer company could bridge it in 2 hours, but the FNLA would have no such capacity. nor would it be within the scope of our program to ship them adequate materials. All road junctions and small bridges were manned by two or three soldiers carrying rifles, who peered at the vehicle vacantly, and then brought up something resembling a salute when they saw Roberto inside. On one occasion, he got out of the VW to give a befuddled young man a lecture and demonstration of the proper position of attention and salute. As we drove on, Roberto gave me a shopping list of things they needed. He kept returning to uniforms and boots for 15,000 men. "I must have uniforms to make them feel like soldiers," he said, "and boots. If I can give them boots, they will fight for me." No one in Roberto's army was receiving regular pay or allowances. They subsisted on sparse rations, foraged in local villages, and were supplied with such weapons, ammunition, and medicines as were available. They were recruited on the basis of loyalty to family and tribe, and although many would flee combat, others were drawn by the historic motivations of war: aggression, camaraderie, excitement, and the promise of wealth when their side won. 30 kilometers out of Ambrees, we turned suddenly onto a dirt road in a grove of commercially planted palm trees. After several kilometers, this led us into a clearing on a small hill where a walled compound encircled large warehouses and outlying buildings. A large sign proclaimed Fazenda Lifuni, the Lifuni Plantation. It was Roberto's forward command post. There were 16 listless soldiers and two 2.4 mortars. To one side, a half dozen women and children were gathered around a cooking pot on a low fire, sitting flat on the bare ground with their legs straight in front. I reflected on the sobriety of the FNLA forces I had seen so far. These camp followers were wives and family. I had seen no bars, prostitutes, or drinking. The lovely women for which Angola had some fame were all in Luanda. I thought ruefully of my paramilitary colleagues who clamored to get into the Angola program because it was the only war there was. For most of them, tours in Vietnam had been exotic experiences with little danger or difficult work, and a gluttony of sensual pleasures. A famous unposed snapshot of one of the agency's upcountry heroes told the story. He's draped in a lawn chair, his feet propped against the sandbags of a bunker, reading the morning's cable traffic, holding a Heineken beer in his right hand while a Vietnamese dolly manicures his left. Assignments in Angola were going to be different. The FNLA had been on the run 2 weeks before when Mobutu and St. Martin had insisted that Roberto take personal command of the battlefield, bringing with him weapons and armored cars from Kinshasa. Now the MPLA was retreating, and Roberto was flushed with his successes. War was easy. They would soon be in Luanda itself. Roberto was dominating every conversation, making every decision, inspecting weapons, thrusting soldiers onto trucks, even checking the gas in a Volkswagen's tank. When we got stuck in the sand, he was the first out of the car, tearing out grass clumps and thrusting them under the tires. Falstaff repeatedly whispered to me that Roberto didn't know what he was doing, didn't take advice, and was creating as many problems as he solved. It was difficult from all this to judge the scope of the fighting, but a picture was emerging. Roberto had claimed 2,000 troops in the area. He claimed they were pushing back 4,000 MPLA. He spoke of heavy fighting and shelling, especially on the Barro de Dande battlefield, where he proudly showed me a disabled Russian BDRM-2 armored car. But I counted only a couple of mortar craters and the bullet marks on buildings from a few magazines of small arms fire. Falstaff, like a Roberto truth squad, whispered that the BDRM-2 had been abandoned before it was hit by the FNLA bazooka round. Barro de Dande was the scene of a small skirmish, not a battlefield. Roberto did not know the difference. Before last week, he had never put his own body on the line. We encountered a truck which was returning from the front with a half dozen prisoners in the back. Roberto questioned the guards while I took photographs of the grim men it held. Roberto volunteered that they would be well treated, but I reflected that I could not blame them for their anxiety, considering the FNLA's tradition of butchering any MPLA it captured. About 4 p.m., we broke into a clearing in the Sasalemba Road junction. There were no buildings, just a paved intersection and a concrete post which read, Luanda, 32 kilometers. A comical baobab tree loomed over the junction, one of its limbs splintered by a 106 round. There were no troops to be seen and no sound of fighting. Commandant Lukenge directed us to the left, and we proceeded cautiously down the road. After a few hundred yards, we came upon the FNLA fighting force clustered together in a shallow dirt pit off to one side of the road. There were about 80 men in the dirt pit, which was large enough to shelter perhaps a tenth that many safely. One large caliber mortar round would have eliminated much of the FNLA fighting force on the Sasalemba front. The soldiers stood on the asphalt and pointed down the road to where the MPLA had counterattacked that afternoon. A few MPLA soldiers, approaching from a half mile away, had fled when the 106 leveled a round against them. That was counted as another battle. The prisoners we had encountered earlier had been taken when an errant MPLA jeep drove into an FNLA position. Kahito, where we drove the next morning, unlike the other sites, looked like the scene of a real battle. We drove through it twice, and I could see no building that hadn't suffered at least one mortar hit. The African houses on both sides of town had been razed. A small church school, which had been the MPLA headquarters, had suffered a devastating attack from the FNLA. Entire cinder block buildings had been reduced to rubble. No wall was unmarked by mortar rounds, shrapnel, and small arms fire. In the yard stood another shattered BDRM-2 and two jeeps, destroyed by repeated hits from 106s and bazookas. Roberto proudly recreated the battle for me, noting that the FNLA fire had been so accurate that a neutral Portuguese army garrison in barracks two blocks away had been untouched. Then Falstaff interpreted, while Chevier told how the Zairean panhards had become disoriented and taken the road to Luanda, and how Roberto had jumped in a car alone and raced after them miles behind MPLA lines to guide them back to the battle. I decided to believe the story. Roberto was now involved, and there was no denying how intensely he wanted Luanda. The Battle of Kahito was a different matter. I walked carefully over the schoolyard, nervously mindful of the dangerous mines and duds which could be detonated by my foot. Studying the layout intently, I formed my own picture of the action. No doubt the compound had been the object of a noisy and expensive attack, but there was no evidence of any defense. There were no bunkers or foxholes, no piles of expended rounds. The armored car and jeeps had been knocked out where they were parked against the wall. The MPLA had fled without making a serious effort at defending Kahito, and the damage had been done by rampaging FNLA forces as they swept through unopposed. Most of the MPLA had fled, but two or three had been caught in the shelling. I snapped pictures of a cadaver in the ruins, wondering what Bubba Sanders would think to do with it. Roberto towed some rebel aside, and retched when a shrunken, grinning corpse stared back at him. The author of The Bloody Revolt of 1961, who insisted that revolution without bloodshed was impossible, was himself weak-stomached. On the scarred wall of the headquarters building, there was a black and red MPLA poster, torn and shredded from bullets and shrapnel. I took it down and folded it into my travel bag. In front of the building, I stopped, my eye caught by a curious memento to the ironies of war. From the rubble of the driveway, I extracted a large rosary, which had been carved from sections of a rough African vine and strung on nylon cord. I coiled it into my bag beside the poster. As we drove back to Ambriz in the early twilight, everyone was silent. I was lost in my calculations, weighing the probable effect of CIA arms on the present level of combat, and speculating about the eventual Soviet backlash. Given the weaknesses of the contending armies, one modern weapon system, such as Puff the Magic Dragon, could make a dramatic difference, completely dominating a battlefront. If we were in a race with the Soviets, the winner would be the first to get effective weapons and leadership into northern Angola. We could do it, if we did it now. The next day, on the flight to Kinshasa, We stopped at the deserted Nagaji Air Base near Carmona and inspected its facilities. It had been designed by the Portuguese to provide military support in northern Angola for anti-guerrilla operations and was capable of handling transoceanic jet aircraft. The control tower, warehouses, and even recreational facilities would be ideal for an American advance base if IA Feature ever became another Vietnam. I was tempted not to mention it to headquarters. As we flew on, I drafted my report. In 2 pages, it was simple enough. But my conclusion troubled me. The opposing forces in northern Angola, the MPLA as well as the FNLA, were poorly armed, poorly led, and disorganized, offering us the opportunity for a quick coup. It was feasible to rush weapons into Angola, which would decisively win the war. I knew that our policy was not designed to win, but I wanted Washington to know that the opportunity existed for a total victory if we provided abundant, immediate support. Since there was no chance of the National Security Council taking bold action in August 1975, I might have served my nation better if I had attempted to discourage them by emphasizing the frailty of the FNLA Army, to which the United States was affixing its prestige. Back in Kinshasa, I handed St. Martin the draft report and went into the guest room for a long shower. When I came out, he handed it back, suggesting only that it should be changed from the first person and put into cable format. Did he agree with it? He brushed the question aside. I should report whatever I wanted. He had, nevertheless, made several minor changes, with the compulsion of all agency managers to edit every draft that crosses their desks. His reluctance to discuss it made me wonder if he would file a separate cable, criticizing mine. On the way back from Ambrees, an ominous turmoil had begun to build in my abdomen, and by the next morning I was in the throes of the Angolan anguish, bacillary dysentery. The medic at the embassy prescribed kaolin pectin and 4 or 5 days' rest, but my plane was to leave the next morning for Savimbi's headquarters in central Angola, and I would be bounced from truck to Land Rover for the next 3 days. I knew that only an occasional sip of paregoric would permit me to complete the mission, and there was none to be had without a prescription. A CIA medic once told me that illness, alcoholism, and emotional problems are responsible for 99% of the CIA's incomplete assignments. To my enormous relief, one of the station's operations assistants found me at St. Martin's at 6 and handed me a dark vial of paregoric, laughing sympathetically at my predicament. "Don't ask any questions," she said. "Just give me 15 Zaires." Footnote. An operations assistant is a secretary, bookkeeper, and girl Friday for the CIA field station. In the 36 CIA posts in Africa, there are perhaps 4 dozen such young women. They are generally 22 to 30, although sometimes older, and make $9,000 to $15,000 a year, plus whatever allowances the different posts offer. In a small post, the ops assistant is one of the 2 or 3 people in the country who knows everything the CIA is doing in that country. She types all cables and dispatches and reads all incoming traffic from headquarters. She keeps the station finance records and the cash box and replenishes each case officer's revolving fund. On a specified day, she closes the books and prepares the monthly accounting, which is then pouched to headquarters. After hours, she is generally invited to all embassy and station social functions, and depending on her tastes and interests, may or may not participate in the social life of the official community. Her relationship with the chief of station is perforce close and often intimate. In most posts, she is involved in operations, functioning as a cutout for agents' reports or money, helping to spot and assess new agent candidates at cocktail parties, and helping with counter-surveillance when any technical operations are running. If her rapport with the COS is not good, the tiny field office can be very stuffy. If she is promiscuous or indiscreet, the station can have serious problems. In one post, the ops assistant fell in love with a leader of the local Communist Party and resigned and married him. The security implications for the station and its agents were mind-boggling, There were agents who would have been in danger if exposed. She knew them all. Their names, how much they were paid, where they met the case officers. One agent who knew that she was witting of his CIA role offered to arrange for her quiet disappearance. This was given no consideration whatsoever. Wholesale changes in personnel eventually diffused the threat. End footnote. Meanwhile, I had lunched with Larry Devlin, my former patron, and the famous Eminence Grease of the Congo program of the early 60s. After two long tours in the Congo, where he had shuffled new governments like cards, finally settling on Mobutu as president, Devlin had been put in charge of the agency's paramilitary program in Laos. And before Laos collapsed, he had returned to Washington to become chief of African Division. One of the CIA's historic great operators, he had dealt with younger case officers and agents like an Irish-American politician, giving out patronage to some and coming down hard on any who stood in his way. In Addis Ababa in 1970, he and I had drunk whiskey from midnight to dawn when I had delivered him to his plane. In 1974, he took his agency retirement pension of $22,000 per year and got a fabulous 4-year contract with a New York financier based on the fact that he alone of all Americans still had an intimate friendship with and ready access to President Mobutu. At stake was a $500 million investment in Zairean mineral resources. Before leaving the agency, he assigned Victor St. Martin as COS Kinshasa. We lunched at a small businessman's club, at his employer's expense. He was bored with his new job and nervous because he was being summoned back to Washington to testify to the Senate's Church Committee about the Congo program. He admitted his physical fitness was not up to par, and I scolded him, urging him to start jogging again. What would he tell the Senate about Lumumba? Certainly he would never perjure himself. His testimony would be consistent with any written record and provable facts. At the same time, I guessed that only he and President Mobutu would ever know the complete truth of Patrice Lumumba's assassination in 1960. Over whiskey, other agency supergrades had bragged to me about their careers, disclosing remarkable operational secrets. Larry would brag too, but when it got to Lumumba, he never had much to say. We shook hands and split, promising to meet a week later in Washington. Meanwhile, I would check out UNITA in central Angola.